From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Kwaizi Umfume. Earlier this year, he left his position as chair of the Congressional Black Caucus to head the NAACP. He wants the NAACP to reach out to young people. His new memoir, No Free Ride, describes his own transformation from gang member to political leader. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new soundtrack for the film She's the One, featuring Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been just over 6 months since Kwaizi Umfume left his position chairing the Black Congressional Caucus to head the NAACP. At a time when the NAACP's relevance is being questioned, Umfume is determined to reach out to young people. In his new memoir, No Free Ride, he tells his own coming-of-age story. He grew up poor in Baltimore, and when he was a teenager, he ran numbers, shot craps, and belonged to a gang. He describes the revelation that got him to leave that life, return to school, and then enter politics. He started his political career in 1978 when he won a seat on the Baltimore City Council. He was elected to Congress in 1986 and became head of the Congressional Black Caucus in 92. Before we hear his personal story, let's get his impressions of the presidential campaign so far. I asked him for his short take on the Republican convention and on the image Republicans presented as the party of inclusion.
The party did a good job in painting a face of inclusion and recognizing the power of the media. It took full advantage of that. I would like the Republican Party now to go beyond images and to really, in a substantial way, start to involve minorities to a greater level, to reach out, to really care about and try to understand those issues that are affecting minority communities that happen to be African American and Latino and Asian throughout this country, so that as we formulate policy, it is a policy that is formulated, at least within the Republican Party, in the future, a policy that has a different sense of heart to it and a different sense of compassion. When you do that, you almost will have to bolt your doors to keep minorities from rushing in. People will embrace those who they feel are embracing them, but when you do not, you have, as you do with this Republican Party, a situation where, at least in the African-American community, less than about 8% identify with the party.
Your impressions of Clinton's signing of the welfare reform bill?
I thought it was a bad move because I think it's a bad bill. We all want to reform welfare. We all believe, no matter where we are in this country, I think at least, that the current system is broken and it really needs to be fixed, and that you should not have any system perpetrated by the government that breeds the sort of dependence that welfare has done over the years. But under the guise of reform, we've created in this country now, vis-a-vis this bill, a bill that does several things that we cannot get away from no matter how much we would like to. It pushes 1 million new children into poverty. It pushes 2.5 million families into poverty. It does away with aid to families with dependent children. And what it essentially does is that it punishes children for the transgressions of their parents or the indiscretions of their parents. And I don't know if that's real welfare reform. Children are the most vulnerable in our society. That's the fastest growing group in poverty as it stands now. And under the guise of reform, I think other things could have been done with that welfare package that go to the heart of dependence and go to the heart of the problem, rather than to punish children.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kwaizi Umfume, and he's the head of the NAACP, former congressman from Maryland, and former head of the Black Congressional Caucus. Your new autobiography, No Free Ride, tells about your experiences coming of age and connects that to your political philosophy today. When you were growing up, your mother worked in a factory. She cleaned houses for white families and also worked very hard in your own home. You say probably the most valuable lesson she gave you when you were growing up was teaching you to fight. How did she do it, and why was that so important?
Well, not so much to fight, but to fight back for what you believed in.
You're right. And, that's a good clarification. Yeah.
Yeah. And to stand up for what you believed in. She thought that one's own convictions indicated one's strength, and that if you didn't believe in something passionately, that you really weren't really living your life the way you should. So that meant an awful lot to me, and she did that in various ways, in her own ways, given the resources that we had and given the few opportunities that may have come our way. But my mother taught me to work hard, play by the rules, love our country, cherish our faith.
Yeah, but she also told you to use your fists to fight back when you needed to. Tell the story of the fight where she made you go back.
Well, there's an instance in the book where Big Neil, who was the bully in the neighborhood, chases me home from school one day. I had been, for one reason or another, able to escape his wrath for several years, but I must have been about 10 or 11 years of age, and I just couldn't make it back to the house. He caught me there, short of my doorstep, and we began fighting, or I should say he began fighting, and I began defending myself. Big Neil was a real big guy who took a great deal of pleasure out of beating up on those of us who were smaller, as I was, and younger, as I was at the time.
Yeah, you were nicknamed Pee Wee.
I was, and I was a Pee Wee. I was very small, frail, and quite frankly, out of my league. He hit hard, he was mean, and he got pleasure watching other people bleed. But there we are fighting and tussling on the ground, and I miraculously just kind of break loose and dart straight toward my door and get to the door and see my mother and start feeling safe that I've arrived at my sanctuary. And she grabs me, shakes me, turns me around, and tells me to go back out to fight. And it was a strange moment for me because my mother was my best friend and one I thought would at least try to protect me. But in this instance, she was going to fight me if I did not go back out and fight Big Neil. And I stood there looking at her as she was shaking me and recognized something in her that I had not seen before, and that was anger at my sort of cowering away and walking away from something that I should fight for. And that was my own dignity and my own respect, even at that age. And so I got back into the fight, and we proceeded to fight each other until we neither of us had any more strength, and we kind of fell out there. And my mother kind of picked me up, dragged me in the house, but was appreciative of the fact that I had fought back to defend myself, not to take advantage of someone, but to defend myself and defend my honor. And for me, it was the first true lesson about fighting back and why it was important, not just in the society, but in terms of life. And it was something that meant a great deal to me at the time.
You describe your father as a brooding hulk of a man who rarely uttered a kind word to you and often hit your mother. When he left the family when you were about 12, you describe it as an answer to your prayers. I guess for you, an intact family wouldn't have been the best thing.
Well, it would have been. It's just that at what price?
Well, not with this particular man.
Yeah, we'd have to ask ourselves at what price.
Mm-hmm.
No, not with him. You know, my father, who I realized at a later point was not my father on the night of my mother's death, but he was very brutal to me for a number of different reasons, most of which had to do with the fact that I was not his son. He knew that, but I did not know it at the time. And was verbally abusive and physically got carried away on those times and in those moments that he drank. So the answer to my prayer was that be removed, that not be a part of what I considered to be our home, our household.
You know, I thought it was really interesting when your father, who turned out to not be your biological father, left the family, you and your family briefly moved into a house that your grandfather, your mother's father, had bought in West Baltimore back in the 1920s, and he bought it with the idea that people then and people in the future from the family would be able to use this house as a temporary shelter if they were down on their luck.
My grandfather was the grandson of a slave, and as the head of the Willis family, having migrated to Baltimore, felt strongly about the power of property and being able to own something in life that meant something. He also, I think, was a visionary, expecting that one day his children and their children could, in fact, find themselves needing property, needing a shelter, if you will, a place to hang their hat, and believing, as he did, that it was the right thing to do. Time has proven him right, because in my own time, I would find myself there. My mother would find herself there, and I have cousins who, for whatever reason, found themselves living there until they were able to move on.
Who's living there now?
My cousin and my uncle.
Kwaizi Umfume is my guest, a former head of the Congressional Black Caucus and now head of the NAACP and author of a new memoir called No Free Ride, From the Mean Streets to the Mainstream. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kwaizi Umfume, former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, now head of the NAACP. He has a new memoir called No Free Ride. You really praise your mother in your memoir and talk about all the strength that she passed on to you. She died when you were 16, and but even before she died, you started getting involved in trouble and getting involved with friends who helped lead you into trouble. For example, when your mother was still alive, you had a friend who, on a dare, tossed a lit match into the car of a Jewish couple, a couple that ran a store, extended credit to your mother, gave you jobs when you needed the money, a couple that your mother considered friends. What was your reaction when you were standing there watching your friend set this couple's car on fire?
I had real mixed emotions. The Potishes, who had migrated to this country, David Potish, whom was a survivor of the Holocaust, lived in our neighborhood and ran a store on the corner across the street from my home. They, like many others in the neighborhood, were not so obsessed with what a person's religion was at the time, but rather they were part of the community. They lived over top of the store. I played with their son, Sammy, and we grew up together. They gave me my first job. They extended family credit to my mother because they knew that she was working to take care of four kids. They were part of the community and, in many respects, part of the extended family. And having been taken into the confidence of the family as I was, many times when Mr. Potish would bring us in and close the door, and I would be there, the only black person in the home at the time, sitting with his son and his daughter, listening to him talk about the stories of the Great Holocaust and watching tears in his eyes and seeing him tremble sometimes and almost unable to speak as he talked to his own children about why it was so important that they understood the magnitude of that tragedy, and to allow me to be a part of that was special. So now, here I am, 15 years of age, and my best friend Buddy, my best buddy Gary, who is always pushing the envelope, finds himself in front of their car, an old Plymouth that Mr. Potish loved and shined every day, on a dare by someone else tossing a match into their car. And here I am standing there trying to quickly talk him out of it, but I'm recognizing at the same time that it's too late. The match is flying through the air. It lands in the Plymouth. A little while later, there is smoke, and we all look at each other and run. By the time we stopped running, though, Gary and I have a confrontation because I realize that he doesn't understand just what he's done and who he has done it to and what the long-term consequences are. But by the time we get back to my house, the police are there. You know, they come and knock on the door. They want to see me. My mother opens the door. She is terribly upset now because she has seen the fire that took place at the car. There are the Potishes outside on their steps with their night clothes on. Mr. Potish wringing his hands, wondering who could have done something like that in this community. And here am I being led out to a police car at age 15, doing something I hadn't done at all. And there's Gary, who is the person who's done this, in the car, in the back seat, smiling.
Pete, you said you had mixed feelings about this. What was the other side of your feelings?
Well, the other side is that when you are out in the street like that and you are part of the group, if you will, or the gang or the mob, you don't try to inject any sort of logic to what's going on. You don't try to be the voice of reason, because that's oftentimes interpreted as a weakness. And so you look what's taking place, and in some instances you join it yourself. That's just part of the street culture. So the mixed feelings had me on one hand feeling like a part of the group, looking at this as just another act taking place, but the other side of me, the real side of me, recognizing that there are faces behind this and that those faces are my friends.
Well, you were arrested, sent to juvenile court. You got off with a reprimand because it was your first run-in with the law, and your mother was working really hard behind the scenes to get character witnesses and get you to publicly apologize and all of that. But that run-in with the law, your mother's horrified reaction at what had happened, didn't keep you on the straight and narrow. You got deeper into trouble as you got older, particularly after your mother died and you were on your own.
Mm-hmm.
What was the allure of the street life to you?
Well, it was a very tough neighborhood there in West Baltimore. It was a neighborhood that would eat you up and spit you out if you couldn't conquer it or be a part of it in such a way that you helped to control it. And what you learned, as I did, living on the street at a very early age and running with all the wrong people at the time, was that you have got to conquer your environment. You can't let it conquer you. It's the same regrettable lesson that many young people are learning on street corners today. After my mother's death, the anger that sat in with me personally at the fact that God, who I had always been told cared about us and would never do anything to harm us, had taken my mother, had left four children, three of my sisters, age 14, 13, and 10 at the time, caused our family to be split up and thrust me into manhood long before I was ever ready to even think about it. So all those emotions were there, and looking back at that, for me, I had every reason, I think, to drop out, every reason I thought I needed to drop out, and so I did. I became the environment that I was a part of. I learned to conquer it in my own way because I had to survive in those streets. And I am blessed in many respects, not lucky, but blessed, that what took place in my life in the summer of 1971 that helped to turn me around did so that I might be here today. Along the way, however, I became a teenage parent with five sons, all of whom are adults now and are good citizens and are good children for me as I get older. But it was difficult in those days and different also to look up with five mouths to feed, no skills. I was a high school dropout because I dropped out immediately after her death to find jobs to take care of my sisters. No hope for the future and no real idea where I was going. I was poor, black, and in real trouble.
My guest is Kwayezi Umfume, and he's the former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, now the head of NAACP, and the author of a new memoir called No Free Ride. Before we get to the transformation that got you out of the street life, I want to talk to you about your biological father. On the night that your mother died when you were 16, a friend of the family who was known to the family as Mr. Charles confessed to you that he was really your birth father.
Mm-hmm.
And he was somebody who you had always looked up to as a kid because he had so much respect in the pool halls and in the neighborhoods. He was a numbers runner. What kind of role model was he to you?
Well, it's relative. Not only was he a numbers runner, but he ended up using drugs and became addicted and in many respects almost lost his own life in those streets because of a behavior that had taken place in his life that came about also through the need to conquer the environment that he found himself a part of. But in terms of a role model for me, I can only speak of the times that we spent together, which were not that many. He was introduced after we had moved back into the city. This was after my stepfather, who I thought was my real father, had pretty much deserted us and left us in a small enclave in Baltimore County. We moved back into the city on the west side of town, and we're living there really trying to make ends meet. My mother, because of the poverty that we were in, ended up moving us five times in a few years from one house to another because there was never enough money to pay the rent or to keep the gas and electric on. But here enters Mr. Charles, who I'm introduced to as a friend of the family and who is a genuinely kind individual, not just to me, but also to my sisters, of whom there is no biological connection, and especially to my mother. The first man that I see now in my house is someone who is treating her with respect and with dignity, who cares for us, who has a sense of humor, who who tries to provide, who mysteriously kind of comes and goes for several years there, and someone who I developed a great deal of attachment toward and fondness of, and oftentimes would quietly wish to myself that if I had a father like that, then being a son would be a lot different than it was for me. So it was rather startling the night of her death that he would come there, as he did, and finish for me the stories that she had begun telling me 3 months prior to her death about what I should know about life and myself and my own history, about my family and about my responsibilities.
Did he become more of a father to you once he confessed that he was your biological father?
I don't know if he became any more of a father or any less. He was devastated by my mother's death. And for 8 years after that death, at least 8 years, he had problems getting his own life back together. What I come to realize later on was that they had loved each other intensely. For some reason, something happened shortly after my birth or as I was a child, and I assume it was the fact that he had gone to jail that caused them to separate. And then entered Clifton Gray, who she ultimately married and who she had three children by, my sisters. So whether or not he was more of a father or less of a father is kind of difficult for me to answer, because from the brief moment that I found out he was my father, my whole world changed as well. I was startled, but at the same time, I was pleasantly surprised. There, just a couple of hours after her death, that as I lose a mother, I am also gaining, in many respects, a father.
Kwaizi Umfume is the head of the NAACP. His new memoir is called No Free Ride. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Kwaizi Umfume was 16 when his mother died, and he had to drop out of school to support his younger sisters. Coming up, we continue our conversation with him about how he went from the streets to politics. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the soundtrack for the film She's the One, featuring Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kwaezi Umfume. Earlier this year, he left his seat in Congress and his position chairing the Congressional Black Caucus to head the NAACP. He's trying to reach out to young people, and he tells his own coming-of-age story in his new memoir, No Free Ride, From the Mean Streets to the Mainstream. When we left off, he was telling us how his life changed at the age of 16. His mother died, and he learned that his mother's estranged husband was not his birth father. Umfume's biological father was a friend of the family's who was often in trouble with the law. How did you support yourself when your mother died? Your stepfather had already abandoned the family. Your biological father wasn't taking a lot of responsibility for you.
Yeah, I indicated early I had to drop out of school, which I did 2 weeks after my mother's funeral. My biological father provided whatever he could then for my sisters and myself, but it was clear to me that I had to do something because one of the promises I made to my mother sitting there those evenings listening to her talk before her death was that I would always look out for my sisters and that I would never let anything happen to them. And so I took jobs shining shoes on the weekends for those persons who were going or coming from church. I carried groceries on Saturdays and Fridays. I got a job in a factory. I lied about my age and said that I was 18 when I was really 17 so that I might be able to get a work permit. I worked the evening shift pushing bread through a slicer at a bakery in town. And I did anything else that was legal at the time to try to make some money. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough to be able to send money to my grandmother who was looking after my sisters and enough for me to live on. I was then living in the house that my grandfather had bought some time ago in a small room on the second floor with an uncle or two who lived there also.
Well, after a lot of legal jobs, you also turned to illegal ways of making money, like running the numbers.
That's right.
Which felt better to you, running the numbers and making more money or having legit jobs and making less?
Well, I tell you, coming home from running the numbers all day long, I didn't have blisters on my hand as I did working in the factory, and I didn't feel half as tired. I don't know if I felt like I had done anything, however, because I was always raised to appreciate work, which is why I've always kept a job in my life.
Can you compare financially for us the difference between your factory work and carrying groceries and how much money you made as a numbers runner?
Yeah, I was getting ready to do just that. In that environment that I grew up in and on those streets, you learn to do a number of things. I talk about in the book how I first learned how to shoot dice and how I was taught that as it being a science, not just something that you did, because as a science, you could learn how to win from it. And I was given an opportunity to run net numbers in the neighborhood by some of the older men who did that and who did it because it was a way of life in the community. Long before the lottery was ever established, the numbers were it. And, you know, I learned the tricks of the trade, if you will, the tricks of the street in order to be able to make money that way and to do that, and I did it well. But I also knew as I was doing it that one day, if I lived long enough, that that would not be enough, not nearly enough for me, for what I had to do. And the risk that was associated with it clearly was something that was an equal turnoff. But there was more money coming in and more money that I was able to take to my grandmother, more money I was also able to use for my own children now with 5 mouths to feed. But it was a difficult, daring, and dangerous situation, and one, again, that I'm blessed to be able to talk about in hindsight now rather than to have been like so many others who were a part of that neighborhood, either in jail or in a grave.
I want to ask you a kind of personal question. And, you know, you've mentioned that you were a teenage father, and I think by the time you were 22, you had fathered 5 different children?
Yes.
What a lot of people wonder is, why once you've learned the hard way that sexuality is related to childbirth, why not use birth control after that? I mean, you were a smart kid. Could you speak to that at all? Why you let that continue happening?
I'll be more than happy to. We're talking about 1968, 1969, 1970. Birth control wasn't flaunted as it is now as an option. I mean, there were no public service messages on TV, no great deal of education in the community about contraception, and quite frankly, a great amount of disdain for contraceptives, particularly among the males of the community who saw their sexual prowess tied to their ability to be able to have affairs or relationships, not necessarily children. In my instance, everything backfired on me, and I write in the book that it seemed as if every time I did it, a child was born. And my kids, having come along as they did, one behind another, in a period of 3.5 years, exemplify the fact that for me, it was not so much learning a lesson about sexual activity being tied to childbirth, but it was rather instead something that just took place and part of the way in which, regrettably, you were measured in those days and how your manhood was measured in the late teens.
So did it affect your reputation one way or another in the eyes of the people who knew that you had several children?
Well, I don't know if it affected my reputation. It certainly affected my outlook on life.
How?
Well, I was always taught responsibility, no matter what. I mean, when people became pregnant, my option was never, okay, let's go try to have an abortion. I never even thought of that. I mean, I never even knew what an abortion was. I knew and I was always taught that you have responsibilities. In this instance, because I have a child, that child is my responsibility, and I have to find a way to take care of it. And it's not even making a statement on pro-choice or pro-life. It's just talking about the way I was raised. So it affected my reality because I realize now it was not just me, but there were other mouths to feed, other lives that had to be shaped and mended. And here I was again, a high school dropout, no skills, very little motivation, low self-esteem, and no real idea of how I was going to pull myself out of that mess to create any kind of a future for myself or my sons.
You know, something else about that period of your life. You were carrying a gun for a while. Why did you start carrying a gun, and did it make you act in ways that you never would have acted?
No, it did not, but I ended up carrying a gun because I had to find a way to defend myself. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was carrying a gun. It's not that different, regrettably, from the way things tend to be in some neighborhoods today. But I had to defend myself. I was a small, physically a small young man. I was in a real tough neighborhood where every day you were tested either by the people who were part of your group, a part of your gang, a part of your mob, or by those who were not. And in some respects, being able to do that said to people that they ought to think twice about challenging you on something. And so I did what most other guys did in that neighborhood who were part of that gang and a part of those streets, not because I wanted to do it, but I certainly wanted to be able to protect myself.
What was the turning point for you? There seemed to be like one flash moment that got you to think, I got to leave the gang, I got to leave the streets.
Well, it was the summer of 1971, the middle of July, and I write in the book about how that night was like other nights that had preceded it in that neighborhood. The ambiance in the street at sunset, the fact that children are leaving the street, and if you will, the older children now are coming about, the toughs, those who really control the corners, how I looked forward to the nightly activity, which was gambling out on the corner, playing the dozens, and again, controlling my own turf and running with my own friends, and how I dashed out of the house after throwing some pomade, Dixie Peach hair grease in my hair, put on a red shirt and ran outside stuffing my 10s and 20s in one pocket, my 1s in another, and my dice in another. And I had red dice, green dice, and white dice. I had learned how to gamble in that respect, and had learned also the ability to make a dollar out on street corners. So it was a regular night. I get to the corner, and it's the regular crowd, and we go through the regular ritual. People are drinking wine. It's a place known as Hankins Corner because Hankins Liquor Store straddles that corner, as it still does today. And it was a strange corner. I'd watched the first person I'd ever seen shot by police shot on that corner. I'd watched one guy that I knew kill his brother on that corner. I learned how to play dice on that corner. I learned the dozens there. It was a corner that, in many respects, held for me a lot of memories, all twisted, all dangerous, and all very, very risky. And it was the sort of corner that we gravitated to because it said to the rest of the neighborhood and those who came through that area that this was our turf. But being out there that night, listening to all that was going on and being a part of it, something strange very inexplicable came over me because I felt extremely cold in the middle of July. My legs became rubbery. I felt myself now up against a wall that I had previously been looking at, almost sliding down it, unable to really talk in any discernible way. My thoughts were clouded, my mouth was parched, and I was undergoing a strange sense of not being here. I almost felt like I was dying and had no control over it. And as those moments raced on, I, in some respects, went into another state, one that I had a great deal of difficulty writing about in this book, because I have never in my life experienced anything like that, and I don't know if I ever will again, but I know that I felt the death angel near me. And in the middle of all of that, I was able to blink my eyes and fight through all of that haze and confusion and see before me in many respects the image of my mother's face looking at me, first in a very awkward manner, as if she were ashamed at what she was looking at, and then later looking back at me and smiling and offering to me the kind of love that I remembered so much that she gave to me. And I felt extremely embarrassed at that moment, believing that if I am really dying, then the worst thing is not to die, but to have died and let my mother down the way I did. And then it all disappeared, and reaching for her, she wasn't there. I just continued in that state and kind of slowly came out of that and realized that all that was going on, the ambiance that was there before, was still there. And people are hollering at me and asking me what's going on, and I'm trying to fight my way back to my feet. But when I got up, I don't know what it was, and I never will know, but I knew at that point I could never continue with what I was doing, that I had to walk away from that corner and walk toward a new life.
My guest is Kwaezi Umfume, the head of the NAACP, former head of the Black Congressional Caucus. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kwaezi Umfume, head of the NAACP. He's written a new memoir called No Free Ride, From the Mean Streets to the Mainstream. Well, it's one thing to leave a gang and to be resigned to leave the street life. It's another thing to find a new life for yourself, a new way of making a living, a new way to live. Mm-hmm. What was your first step in that direction?
My first step was like the first step that had preceded that. I had to find a way to defend myself. You just don't walk up to a gang and say, okay, here's my letter of resignation. I'm giving you 2-week notice, thanks, but I'll see you later. Because we had taken a vow, if you will, to stay together until death separated us. That's what held gangs together, that kind of sacred trust and a willingness to do anything for the other person. And so what I found then is that I had to defend myself almost daily from persons who were part of that gang, who were heretofore those who would protect me. They were now challenging me, and whether they had chains in their hands or baseball bats or whether they had knives, they would come after me every time they saw me on the street because they thought that I had forsaken them, number one. I had forsaken the trust that I had been a part of and that I was turning soft or perhaps even cooperating with the police against them. And so I carry today a lot of scars in my head, on my hand, in the back of my neck, on my legs, from those fights of trying to defend myself against 2 and 3 guys at a time who really were trying, in some respects, not just to break my spirit, but to kill me if they could, because I had done the unthinkable. Fortunately, after several months of that, they just kind of left me alone. I guess they got tired of watching me lying on the ground in my own blood, crawling in a gutter, trying to get myself to a pair of steps or to rush into somebody's house that I might be able to be treated for the way I was bleeding, and they just kind of left me alone. They either thought that I was crazy, because I always fought back, and I never seemed to go back on my word to myself that I was walking away, or they thought that I was onto something that was clearly much more powerful than that corner, and they were right.
What politicized you?
1968 did it for me. I'm a product of the 1960s. I watched the turmoil. I watched the expressions of change. I watched all that was going on in this country as it wrestled with its own conscience, with its own real meaning. And in 1968, 2 months after the assassination of Dr. King and of all the riots that occurred in cities around this nation, 2 months after the birth of my first child, and 2 months really before the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, I had an experience on that same street corner with a gentleman who was later to become the first African-American member of Congress from the state of Maryland by the name of Perrin Mitchell. The Vietnam War was raging. The president had just stepped up our commitment to send troops, I believe, into Cambodia. There were a great deal of protest all over the place. And here is this man that I bump into on my corner, on my turf, passing out literature and talking to those of us there as if he knew us or as if he were not afraid of us, asking us to get involved. And if we really wanted to change things and to change the community, that we really had to change the system, and that he wanted to be a member of Congress to do that.
Right, and you insulted him.
Well, I insulted him because I thought he was insulting me and my intelligence. He was on my turf, and he was on my terms at that point. And I said to him, old man, and he couldn't have been any more than about 47 at the time, but it was relative. I was probably about 19 myself. I said, old man, do you know what you're doing? Do you know whose ground you're standing on? And do you know what can happen to you out here? And he just looked at me as if he were looking through me and didn't seem to blink, but began again to tell me about why it was important to change politically the things that were around us that we might be able to change ourselves and ultimately change our nation. And that dialogue continued, and it got more hostile on my part. And he noticed a gun. He noticed my anger. And he said to me, insultingly, that as long as I was there, selling, as we used to refer to them, as wolf tickets, talking bad, and really not saying anything, that I was more of the problem than I was of the solution. And when I grew up, that I should come and see him or see someone who was prepared really to fight back, and to do it in a real and meaningful way. And he suggested by giving me his card that I come and talk to him later and be a part of this movement, this part of change. I knew he was a member of the famous Mitchell family in Baltimore. His brother, Clarence Mitchell, was referred to as the 101st Senator. They were very much involved with the NAACP.
Mm-hmm. But, did you ever take him up on his offer?
I did. I don't know why, but I did. I can't explain why I did. I knew if that had gone on much longer that something else would have ensued on that corner, but he left, and, you know, I went back to being my own non-productive self. But a couple of weeks later, I found myself standing at his headquarters asking to see him. And he sat down and talked with me and explained to me why it was important that particularly young people my age got involved and what it meant to fight back, not just to stand there, but to fight back. And then how, again, he wanted to be the congressman and how Hubert Humphrey was running for president. And I heard about Mr. Humphrey and had a great deal of respect for him in my own way because he seemed to always tell the truth and not be overcome by the challenges of his time. So I passed out literature that summer for Perrin Mitchell and passed it out for Hubert Humphrey. That was the closest I had come to a political campaign whenever I could and in my own way because, you know, I had still did not want to give the impression that I was selling out to a larger system.
Now, this story has a really interesting ending because eventually when Perrin Mitchell was elected to Congress, when he left his seat, that's the seat that you won, right?
That's correct.
Now, another story that you tell in the book, and I want to get to this. The book opens with a 60 Minutes following you around in your old neighborhood, and they're doing a story on you. And you kind of take on the role that Perrin Mitchell took on for you. You know, there's tough kids, you know, gangbangers on the street corner who are looking at you as the man. You're the establishment. You're the old man now. And you talk to one of the tough kids and give him your card and say, look me up sometime. You know, you should go back to school. I can help you. He continues to insult you, throws your card on the ground.
Pulls out his gun and sticks it up against my head as he leans in and tells me that I'm on his ground. And, oh, man, do you know what you're doing? It's almost 25 years to the date that I had that same experience with Perrin Mitchell, and it was very ironic.
So he never called you back, though, right?
He never called me back. He didn't take my card. He let it fall to the ground as he was supposed to have done. He would have been measured had he taken that by all those others that respected him but who really wanted to be the leader of that mob. He did what he had to do, and I understood that. But I also understood as I looked in his eyes what he was saying and what was crying out, because it was the same thing that was crying out in me 25 years ago. You're hoping and praying that somebody really hears you.
But now how do you go about continuing trying to rescue somebody from the street life when their response is to pull a gun on you and insult you?
Well, first of all, life is not promised. And I think there's more risk to life than we sometimes assume. And we think that if we're comfortable and everything is going fine, then we have reduced risk. But we really haven't, because those young men who are African-American, who are Latino, who are poor white, who really are striking back and striking out of the system, we can't contain them in some neighborhood or lock them off in some special area and assume that they will not interact with us, because they will and they do. They are part of the crimes that take place. They are part of the fear that's bred in us daily as we walk down streets and drive through neighborhoods. We can't turn our backs on them. So for me, it was less risk to confront him there and to offer him an opportunity, but also to communicate to him face to face, even in that tense moment, the fact that I understood what he was going through, that I had gone through it myself, and that my absence of fear said to him that perhaps if he could find a way back to me, that there was someone who cared and some way out of that situation.
But this is the point where a lot of people give up. You know, if your attitude is going to be to threaten me, to insult me, then the heck with you. I'm going to spend my energy on somebody else.
Well, and that's not a bad attitude to have. I just believe that you'll know when you can't go any further with someone else, when it's really hopeless. And I didn't think it was totally hopeless in that case.
Kwoizi Mfume is the head of the NAACP. His new memoir is called No Free Ride. Coming up, a review of Tom Petty's new album, the soundtrack for the new film She's the One. This is Fresh Air. The soundtrack to the new movie, She's the One, is also the first new album by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in over 5 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker says this new collection finds Petty in a melancholy mood.
Some days are diamonds, some days are rocks, some doors are open, some roads are blocked. Sundowns are golden, then fade away. And if I never do nothing, I get you back someday, 'cause you got a heart.
When he started out 20 years ago, people used to mistake Tom Petty's singing voice for that of Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. The story goes that McGuinn himself heard Petty's song Listen to Her Heart on the radio, and McGuinn called his manager to ask when the devil the Byrds had recorded that tune. 2 decades later, Tom Petty's cracked yet damp voice, a timbre as humid as his native Florida, is one of the most instantly recognizable sounds in rock music, and his work on the She's the One soundtrack represents some of his most interesting labor.
I hope you never fall in love. Hope you never get your heart broken. I hope you never fall in love with
You don't go to a Tom Petty album for breathtaking innovation. His pleasures are those of the familiar. When he's working well, he can take small variations on his signature style and invest them with new meanings. On She's the One, Petty has crafted a series of songs filled with wistful doubt. His drawl frequently lingers behind the drumming and his own rhythm guitar. If this CD hadn't been promoted as a movie soundtrack, you'd barely suspect that that's what it is. It coheres as an album, an independent piece of artistic work. The only concessions to cinematic tradition are a pair of instrumentals, nice and contemplative ones, and a couple of cover versions of other people's songs, something that's rare in Petty's career. He tackles a typically gnomic song by Beck, that guy who gave us the hit single Loser, and offers this blunt version of Lucinda Williams' Change the Locks.
I changed the lock on my front door so you can't see me anymore. And you can't come inside my house and you can't lie down on my couch. I changed the lock on my front door. Change the number on my phone so you can't call me up at home. And you can't say those things to me that make me fall down on my knees. I changed the number on my phone.
Whether he's playing with the Heartbreakers or making solo music or yowling with the Traveling Wilburys, Tom Petty has managed to resist becoming either an oldies act or a puzzled veteran struggling to make music for people half his age. The comfort and pleasure he takes in making music serves as a steadying contradiction to the unhappiness that's often the subject of his songs. As the years go by, he continues to be a welcome companion.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the soundtrack to the new film She's the One. The movie opens this week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
California's been good to me. Hope it don't fall into the sea. Sometimes you got to trust yourself. It ain't like anywhere else. It ain't like anywhere else. It's time to roll. I'm all done. This time we better hit the road. I got work later on.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.